everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call our Capital Investment Committee meeting to order. Senator Pappas is running late from one of her meetings, and so I will be, as a vice chair, convening the meeting until she gets here. So first off, we have a report by the Department of Administrator, the Assistant Commissioner, Mr. Wetzlaski. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
Thank you, yes. Madam Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wetzlaski, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to present our 2023 Asset Preservation and CAPRA reports. With me today is Greg Ewig. He's the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services with ADMIN, and Greg's going to walk through the presentation.
Thank you, Wayne, Chair, members. Again, for the record, Greg Ewig, the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the State of Minnesota Department of Administration. So first, some context to ground us in our topic today. To help illustrate the critical needs to fund agency asset preservation requests, consider the following. The state has almost 5,000 buildings, about 34 million square feet. The buildings have a replacement value of around $11 billion, and their average age is around 42 years old. Based on our forecasts, we have about $2.2 billion in deferred maintenance on our portfolio. So the governor has recommended that a significant portion of the bonding bill be allocated to fund asset preservation projects. Asset preservation is becoming an increasingly important challenge for state agency operations. Asset preservation provides improved safety and better government while protecting state investments in the following ways. First, the funding asset preservation and maintaining property stewardship ensures that staff, the public, and guests are kept safe and that functional needs are optimally met. Second, timely planned preventative maintenance reduces total cost of ownership, freeing up resources for other core program functions. And the cost to maintain a building is cheaper than the cost to repair it, as represented on the chart here shown above. The green line on the graph highlights the cost per square foot to repair state-owned buildings, depending on building condition. And the blue bar is reflective of the percent of state-owned buildings within each building status category. Addressing some of the backlog and remaining current on repairs is efficient budgeting because it costs more to fix breaks and respond to emergencies than to fund planned upkeep. And lastly, funding asset preservation saves energy and reduces greenhouse gases. Modern, properly operating buildings use less energy and water, making agency buildings more operationally efficient while reducing energy costs. Eligible asset preservation projects are statutorily defined, but the list in this slide is representative of just some of the types of projects our state agencies have completed with asset preservation funding. They're the core building systems that you think about: heating, ventilation, windows and roofs, but also include hazardous materials abatement, such as asbestos or lead paint. On this map, you can see the high-level view of some of the asset preservation projects occurring now, and which are spread throughout the state. In 2023, 20 counties had asset preservation projects occurring. The details shown on these charts are taken from the 2023 asset preservation report we delivered earlier this year. And as we dig into the numbers from the report, I'd be remiss if I didn't say on behalf of the agencies, thank you for the support from the last legislative session. The charts show the money received for asset preservation purposes. Agencies are using the last remaining 2020 funds and will close out the appropriations by the end of this calendar year. To reorient members, the Department of Administration receives the funding and coordinates construction management services for the agencies. And at the top level, the legislature appropriated asset preservation funding of $44.3 million in 2020 and almost $70 million in 2023. Additionally, the Department of Administration received funding of $9,391,000 from the general fund in the state government finance bill for asset preservation of the Capitol complex buildings and infrastructure, not shown on the charts here. The two charts on the slide here are the amounts spent on asset preservation projects during calendar year 2023. Agencies spent about $11.4 million out of 2020 asset preservation funds and about $18 million in 2023 appropriations. The agencies are expected to have encumbered or expended all 2020 asset preservation funds by the end of this year. I'll spend a few moments just doing a highlight, highlighting some of the asset preservation fundings by the agencies. To start with, the Department of Corrections spent nearly $22 million at 11 locations throughout the state, including plumbing, HVAC, and improved security measures such as security fencing and other related systems. Roof and water updates were also prioritized this year. The Department of Human Services spent approximately $3.7 million at 5 locations throughout the state, and that included replacement of water mains, sewers, in addition to roofs, windows, and tuck pointing. The State Academy spent roughly $550,000 at their campus to repair concrete and their security corridor. And Veterans Affairs spent approximately $14.8 million at 7 locations with work on HVAC upgrades, exterior repairs, and replacing a sanitary sewer line on the campus. Looking ahead, here is a overall summary of the 2024 agency asset preservation requests. Shifting gears, we'll update the committee on the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account Report, or more commonly known as CAPRA. To start with, CAPRA are funds that are appropriated to the Department of Administration and used by agencies primarily for unanticipated emergencies or hazardous materials abatement. They may also be used to address life safety issues. Although overlap exists in what can be funded through CAPRA funds, the CAPRA program is distinguishable from asset preservation funding by the fact that it's mostly focused on emergency type of needs. Since 2002, the state has appropriated roughly $54 million, almost $55 million for the CAPRA appropriations. And work last year was a little bit more clustered around the Twin Cities, and this is more, it did impact 8 different agencies, including areas primarily around the Twin Cities, 7 County Metro Area, St. Cloud, Faribault, and St. Peter. The balances shown here in these two charts on the left is a representation of the current CAPRA balances, and on the right is the overall expenditures by year. Focusing on the last 4 years, you can see that the balances remain steady or increased, while expenditures are finally getting back to more traditional expenditure patterns post-pandemic. As noted on the previous chart, the CAPRA account has a $10.3 million balance, which is available for agencies to use for emergencies. Agencies have spent about $2 million last year. And noted here, we are expecting to spend down the majority of the 2020 appropriations by the end of this calendar year. The chart here shows the 2023 CAPRA allocations by agency and projects. Think of this as really an active projects list. The amounts shown here are amounts budgeted for these projects. Just given their very nature of, you know, emergent needs, sometimes the scopes are not entirely clear. So this is really shown to represent what we've allocated for these individual projects. Something to keep in mind about CAPRA funding, the state does have approximately 1,000 buildings representing about 6.4 million square feet that are in poor crisis condition. We always monitor and make sure that there aren't any emergency situations arising, but they do happen. And that's really what we allocate CAPR for. Another note, no projects were funded using the 2023 appropriation yet. However, we are setting them up if in anticipation of any emerging needs that may be occurring. In closing, again, agencies, thank you all for your past support of asset preservation and CAPRA. And the agencies can attest that regular predictable investment in asset preservation and CAPRA funding improves building performance and the higher costs otherwise needed to allocate, to address building failures. Investments in the asset preservation funding now allow agencies to reallocate funds to deliver programs to their citizens, taxpayers, and all those who enjoy the use of our buildings. Thank you, and we stand ready for any questions.
Thank you, again, Assistant Commissioner Wislosky and Mr. Ewig. I do have a question, not so much about CAPRA, because I understand that that's an emergency fund. And so if you don't have an emergency, you know, but that's okay, you've got that fund. But it always kind of surprises me how long it takes to spend the dollars for asset preservation. We know that there's such a huge need and a big backlog, yet we still are working out the 2020 appropriation, my understanding, and that was like 3.5 years ago. So can you just kind of talk us through that, is why it's just so slow? Because it makes us wonder, well, should we spend more money on this when you already have all this money and you haven't been able to spend it? And then I know there's always a fear that we won't pass bonding bills in the future. So maybe that's some advice you could give us.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, it's a very good question, and just to your last point, having consistent level funding is easier to manage than the spikes.
Then up and down.
But I would just say that once funding is received, you obviously go through a series of steps involving the design phase, so hiring the architectural and engineering firms to put together the designs. Then we go through the procurement process to bid that work out.
The what process?
Procurement process.
Procurement process.
Yeah, for bidding the work out. And then obviously is the contractor actually delivering the project. So this follows a fairly normal pattern that we have over the years, as far as it's really a bell-shaped. That first year after you receive appropriations, you know, you're roughly able to spend somewhere in that 15-20% range, and then ramp it up after that as you get into the out years. 35% year two is probably a close average, and same.
How much in year two?
35%
in year two.
35% in year three is a rough estimate. And again, all these funds are allocated. As you know from the deferred maintenance list, the need mm-hmm. greatly exceeds the funding available. And agencies have prioritized how to allocate and spend those funds. So all these funds, not only from the 2020 appropriation, but the 2023 and any funding that's provided this year, will be immediately allocated to projects. It's just getting it into the queue, get the design work done, and then get the construction delivered. And then it's also working in secure facilities, obviously with our correctional facilities, mm-hmm. Our DHS facilities. There's a lot of coordination that happens at the facility level to make sure their programs are able to remain operational as these projects are being completed.
Are there any capacity issues with the Department of Admin in being able to move these projects along in terms of approving, you know, getting the firms to approve the architectural design and the procurement process? You know, is there a staffing issue with you all? I think we're going to hear from Deed next, and we did give them a lot of work to do for sure.
Madam Chair, members, I would say that it follows the when we get a large bonding bill. Obviously, this is now what you would hear is our project managers have anywhere from 30 to 35 projects that they're individually managing, mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of individual projects to work through pipeline, and then you have the procurement folks, the work folks that work on the bidding process. So there's
and the bidding process takes time,
and all that takes time and takes resources. So it
right
as you get in year two, then it levels out a little bit. But you, again, the needs are far exceed the available resources. The agencies, you know, they're obviously anxious to get the work completed. It's just a matter of coordinating with the facilities and then getting through the overall process.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kip. Thank you.
Do we have the Deputy Commissioner, Mr. McKinnon, from the Department of Employment and Economic Development? Here's the reports you were talking about. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourselves for the tape.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Kevin McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at DEED, and members, happy to be here this afternoon.
You do have to speak a little bit louder, because that mic is not great.
Okay.
I'll let you know. Keep talking.
Okay. Good afternoon, and I'll be just giving you an update on what happened last year as it relates to DEED and where we are from a progress perspective with the grantees that we've been working with. That is a good photo. hopefully we can get the PowerPoint up here in a second. But as all of you know, last year we have a historic slate of grant programs that came to DEED, almost $2 billion to our agency, and that has meant that we've been extremely busy and that we've been extremely busy hiring staff and getting staff trained and certainly doing a lot of outreach to the communities. We have been making significant progress on implementing a lot of the initiatives at DEED. And as such, we are in the same process with the capital investment bill. So part of the $1.8 billion that we received last year, obviously, was a significant amount was in capital investments. We certainly have our three existing programs that we'll talk about, a couple of those here in the next segment. Our infrastructure programs for communities. We have a new child care program, but really where I think the meat of this report here today will be is on the 120 or so provisions that we had allocating some general obligation bonds and cash to a number of local projects in the capital investment bill. So, okay.
Luckily, we have the backup here.
Great, thank you. Okay. So, as it relates to implementation, as I mentioned, we received about 120 projects through the two capital investment bills. All the projects are assigned to staff. We have held a number of outreach sessions to all of the grantees in concert with MMB, actually, so that everybody's getting the information that they need from certainly from the agencies, and then establishing an avenue for addressing questions or issues. We are also, in addition to that, as we've hired new staff, obviously there's not a lot of staff or a lot of people that want to work at DEED that have a lot of experience in this, so we've been really focusing on the training aspect of this between our division and the Workforce Development Division. I think we've hired four new people to help administer these programs.
Excuse me, did you say you hired four new people or 40?
Four.
Four to be supervisors?
Not to be supervisors, to actually be the grant managers.
Okay.
Madam Chair, yes. We also have obviously existing staff that deal with general obligation bonds and some of these other appropriations. But nonetheless, there's a whole team of people. I think in all there's about 15 people that work on these. They meet every 2 weeks to discuss issues and certainly to update all the tracking that we are doing to make sure that we know where everybody is in the process. So with that, we have finalized and or are awaiting signatures on a little over a dozen projects right now. Our grantees that we are working with tell us that about two dozen more tell us that they will be ready in the next 3 months or so to proceed. So that's really where we are at the moment on the update. We've been working very closely, as I mentioned, with MMB. MMB obviously plays a critical role here in helping the projects understand some of the requirements, and they have spent a lot of time on this as well and meeting with the grantees along with us. So any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah, we'd be interested in any suggestions or advice that you have for us on how we could better prepare the grantees. That last year obviously was a banner year, and that kind of resources is probably not going to be available again in the near future, but who knows. So that's one thing. And the other thing, I'd be really interested in seeing which ones are approved and which ones are almost approved, so I have a sense of how we're moving along. And then if you can give me just some ideas, Deputy Commissioner, of specific barriers that you've been running into with some of the grantees.
Madam Chair and members, some of the, and we'd be happy to get you the list of who's been approved, who's in the queue, that sort of thing. As far as some of the issues that we are encountering on a lot of these projects, and irrespective of whether it is a local unit of government or whether it's a nonprofit, the issues are pretty much the same, and it always revolves around full funding. And until you have full funding and the types of funding that you have, that will determine some of your other issues that you may have, whether it be a lien issue or whether it be pre-design or some of the other requirements that come with capital investment funding. So we work through a lot of those issues on a case-by-case basis. These are all very different projects, and every grantee has different issues that we have to somehow solve and come to an amicable agreement that obviously meets the intent of the regulations that we're trying to follow. As I mentioned, MMB does play a big role in this and has been extremely helpful in the process. As far as our grant managers and how we approach this as well, we are trying to connect people with different lenders and different things that we know may be more favorable in certain situations just based on previous history. I think, as I mentioned, irrespective of whether it's a local unit of government or a nonprofit, you still have that full funding issue. And that's where most of these are probably being held up, is documenting that full funding that's available for the project.
Some organizations, while they're waiting for the contract to be approved, or they're maybe even waiting to be funded, they take out what you might consider a bridge loan. What do you consider a bridge loan? Because it's my understanding that if they complete the project before the contract is signed, that they're not refundable for the dollars that they've spent. Maybe you could just talk through that a little bit around, because a lot of groups, because it is a reimbursement system, they do take out bridge loans to cover their expenses until they get their reimbursement from DEED. Am I clear my question?
Madam Chair, I believe so.
Okay.
You are correct. DEED operates on a reimbursement basis. As far as bridge loans and how and to what date are costs reimbursable, that might be a question for MMB. Off the top of my head, it's typically in capital investment. I believe it's the date of enactment that you go back to, unless it's otherwise stated in law. But MMB is obviously here, and they could probably correct me if I'm wrong.
We'll be in conversation with them, and we can take up that question then with them.
Yep.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions for DEED and their process? There should be more questions. I have a sense that people are kind of impatient with getting their projects funded, but so have you got that sense from people at all that is there a backlog? I know you said you hired people, you have 15 people total, but do you feel like things are moving along smoothly or that there's still, obviously you'd probably say that they were. I just really want to get the money out the door, and I'm just trying to figure out if there are any barriers there that we could help with to make sure these projects are getting their money, because it does seem like it just takes a long time.
Madam Chair, yeah, and members, that is probably an accurate assessment that these projects take a long time. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether it's a local unit of government or it's a nonprofit, these capital investment projects typically always take a long time. Are there some projects that were more ready to go than others? Yes. Yes, there are, and many of those are completed as of now. There are still some that are out there, but I will say is until they satisfy all the requirements in the agreements, we unfortunately can't move forward. And so that too is what would be holding a lot of these things up. But so is there urgency? Is there a need on behalf of some of the projects? Yes. Is that something that that we're trying to work through and work through the issues so that they can comply? Absolutely, yes. We want to get the money out too, but we also have to make sure that it gets out in the appropriate way.
So I'm just thinking out loud that we ask a lot of groups, we tell them when we're on the bonding tour that we're the last dollar in, and so they have to have identified where they're going to get their funding source, and we ask them these questions to make sure. I think maybe we could even do a better job of that, to know that they're really ready. I mean, every project will tell us they're shovel ready, right? And in many cases, they're not quite there. So I think for all of us, when we're working with our members and we're working with our own projects, we just have to be really, really clear that this money's just gonna sit there for years if you haven't raised all your match or fulfilled all the requirements. And we really don't. You know, there are plenty of projects out there that are ready to go. So, Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. McKinnon. A question on BDPI. I think I've been carrying that bill for, 8 years now, and it seems in previous years there was more of a demand, and we were always worried about running out of that. And looking at the balances now where it's at, it doesn't seem like it's as much active as it used to be. Is there a reason it's not as active, or has it been active? I'm just off on my numbers, but I know I requested, I think it was a $20 million bill this year, I think it was $10 million last year, and I did it last year because we thought we were running low and we were going to be out of money, and now I see we have a balance, or a decent balance, I guess. So can you comment on that? And I've always wanted to keep that fund full so we're not turning away projects, because very, very important for Minnesota to have that money ready, so if a project comes in, we have that money, because a lot of times companies will look at multiple states, and if that money's not there, they're going to go somewhere else, because in today's society, everybody's looking for incentives to locate to their states. So can you just talk a little bit about the balance of BDPI, and has that been irregular in the last couple of years, or how that's been going?
Senator, it's a great transition. So Deputy Commissioner, you might as well move on then to that.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Senator Jasinski.
Oh, it's not the transition? All right. I think it is. It's the next.
I can answer your question on the demand side of BDPI. I don't think demand has dropped for BDPI. We will be talking about that in a minute. About it, but okay. We too recognize.
I see you later on the agenda. So
yep.
Sorry.
Yep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in since I didn't have the slideshow. I didn't know if we were going to go to that or not, so I just didn't want to miss my opportunity to ask the question about it. Thanks.
I was looking at the slideshow too, Senator Jasinski, and Ms. Carlson pointed out the agenda. Thank you very much. Then, if there's no further questions, we'll have you back then in a few minutes.
Thank you.
Then we are going to MMB then next, so that's helpful because then maybe we can get that question about bridge loans answered and anything else. All right, great. Welcome, Commissioner Campbell. You know, and introduce yourself again for the tape and Ms. Convoy.
Good afternoon, Chair Pappas, Vice Chair Paugh, Lead Housley, and members of the committee. My name is Erin Campbell, and I am the Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm here today to present the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's infrastructure plan. Today, I will provide an overview of the capital budget process, discuss the growing needs for Minnesota's infrastructure, provide an overview of the Governor's infrastructure plan, and walk through the capital budget financing of this plan. First, the capital budget process. MMB collects information for the capital budget following a statutorily directed process, which is open to state agencies and political subdivisions whose capital projects are generally eligible for general obligation bonds. Requests are developed in odd number calendar years and published with the governor's recommendations in January of even numbered calendar years. This process is facilitated by MMB. After the capital budget system opened in May, MMB hosted Q&A sessions and provided instructions and assistance to agencies and political subdivisions submitting projects. Initial information for projects was published in July. Then, this fall and winter, MMB went on bonding tours, conducted meetings, and reviewed projects. On January 16th, the governor's recommendations and all final requests were published. On the screen are just a few of the highlights from a few of our site visits. We were visiting wastewater treatment plants and hearing about the importance of our public facilities programs for local governments and seeing state asset preservation needs. As I know you're aware, there's an increasing demand for capital projects this cycle. A total of $7.6 billion in requests have been received from state agencies and political subdivisions for the 2024 capital budget. $4.7 billion is requested from state agencies, which is a 16% increase from last cycle. And $2.9 billion is requested from local governments, more than double the amount requested last cycle. State agencies who own buildings and other infrastructure requested asset preservation and renovation funding. These projects began to address the deferred maintenance backlog in state infrastructure, which for buildings alone has grown 74% since 2015. The current backlog is $6.4 billion, combining state agencies and higher education, and you can see the breakdown in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. The $6.4 billion in outstanding deferred maintenance on the previous slide does not include other state-owned infrastructure, such as roads and bridges, water infrastructure, and physical assets, many of which are maintained by the DNR, the DOC, and DHS. For example, on the left, DNR replaced a bridge, and on the right, DNR replaced an aging culvert with asset preservation dollars. When rebuilding, DNR considered stream flow, ecosystem design, and the effects of more intense rain events so that these resources are available for use for years to come. It is urgent that we invest in asset preservation this session for a variety of reasons. First, it's cheaper to maintain infrastructure than to fix it when it fails. It costs $14 per square foot to repair buildings in excellent condition versus $159 per square foot in crisis condition. 56% of state buildings and systems are in fair, poor, or crisis condition. Additionally, state of Minnesota buildings have an average age of 42 years. The largest and most expensive of all asset renewal projects tend to occur when a building is over 30 years old. As a result, significant funds are needed to be reinvested in these buildings to preserve what we have. The majority of state-owned buildings are more than 30 years old, so it's critical that we reinvest in them so they can serve Minnesotans for many years to come. Of note, there are state-owned assets in all 87 counties, so investing in them touches all corners of our state. Next, I'll be walking through the governor's infrastructure plan on a high level in upcoming hearings, and I think yet today, other state agency leaders will be presenting their projects in greater detail. The headline here is the governor's infrastructure plan takes care of what the state has already built. This plan is designed to focus on the most critical needs while keeping in mind the historic bonding bill from last session, the largest in state's history. A major focus of the governor's plan is investing in asset preservation. Last session, the state's needs didn't receive as high a share of the bill as in the past. Asset preservation was 10% of the 2023 enacted package and was 43% of the governor's recommendations. Importantly, these recommendations are fiscally responsible. This plan stays within the state's debt capacity guidelines of $830 million in general obligation bonds. I'll make a note that rating agencies view the state's adherence to those debt guidelines as a positive factor when determining the state's overall credit rating. This plan is also within the $82 million balance in our forecast after inflation at the end of FY27 and spends only $28 million in general fund cash above forecast. This plan is also within the $84 million balance in the Trunk Highway Fund. This pie chart shows the main categories of the governor's recommendations, and the next slides will provide some more detail. 45%, almost half, is focused on asset preservation and renovating existing state spaces. 22% is for water and transportation infrastructure. 14% relates to public safety. 10% is for housing and the environment. And 9% is for other priorities, including a variety of grant programs. I'll just note that overall, 25% of the governor's recommendations are for grants to non-state entities like local government, so they would pass through. $441 million of the plan is to preserve state infrastructure. $103 million is for the University of Minnesota Heber. $103 million is for Minnesota State, of which $82 million is for Heber, and $21 million is for the St. Paul College Project. And $202 million is for state agency preservation, asset preservation, excuse me, including 76% for the Department of Corrections, which has extensive deferred maintenance needs. $22 million is included for other state agency renovation projects, including $13 million for the Department of Human Services, to replace water and sewer infrastructure at the St. Peter campus. That particular infrastructure has exceeded its useful life and would impact clients and staff considerably if it fails. $216 million of the plan is for water and transportation infrastructure. $40 million is included for MnDOT to address state bridges deteriorating into poor condition across the state. $37 million is included for the Met Council to keep the H-Line bus rapid transit project advancing between downtown Minneapolis and the east side of St. Paul. $109 million is included for the Public Facilities Authority water infrastructure loans and grants, including $10 million for lead service lines and $18 million for new grants to address contaminants in drinking water for local governments. And $10 million is included for a new pollution control agency grant to address contaminants in drinking water for privately owned wells. $143 million of the plan is for public safety. $75 million is included for Department of Public Safety investments, including $48 million for the new Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Facility in southern Minnesota, providing investigatory and laboratory analysis for criminal investigations in the area of the state with high need. Also included are $4 million for design and land acquisition for an expansion of the BCA regional office and lab in Bemidji. And $22 million is for design and land acquisition for a new state patrol headquarters building. In addition, $47 million is included for the Department of Corrections to expand education and programming space at the Rush City facility, where they lack sufficient space for programming to transform lives for safer Minnesota. $98 million of the plan is for housing and the environment. $50 million is included for housing infrastructure bonds, bonds to develop housing across the state, including permanent supportive housing, preservation of federally assisted housing, and deeply affordable new construction. $7.5 million is included to preserve existing public housing to keep it safe and healthy for residents. $16 million is included to update the Minneapolis Veterans Home, Building 16, to better serve its residents, bring the facility up to code, and to address systems that have periodic failures. $10 million is included for the Board of Water and Soil Resources to acquire permanent easements in ecologically sensitive areas, improving water quality by reducing nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment from entering streams and rivers. And $7 million is included for the Department of Natural Resources to acquire high-priority parcels and improve existing state lands through actions such as replanting and seeding trees after timber harvest. And finally, $85 million of the plan is set aside for investments in other areas. There's $40 million set aside for local projects. $20 million is included for MnDOT to maintain, expand, and construct MnDOT-owned buildings, such as adding mechanical space at its St. Cloud headquarters, which was built in 1969 and needs more space for snow removal and other equipment. $12 million is included for the DNR to modernize existing and invest in new facilities, such as expanding the Hibbing Drill Corps Library to meet their statutory requirement to store mineral exploration samples. And $5 million is included for the Department of Human Services for grants to political subdivisions, nonprofits, and tribal governments to construct and renovate early childhood facilities. Overall, the governor's plan is estimated to leverage $640 million in additional funds, such as federal and local funds. Examples include $39 million in PFA state match is estimated to unlock $196 million in federal funds. Investing $40 million in MnDOT high-priority bridges is estimated to unlock $160 million in federal funds. The $37 million for Met Council's bus rapid transit is estimated to unlock $75 million in federal funds. And the $50 million in housing infrastructure bonds is estimated to unlock another $50 million in local, federal, and private investment. Finally, I'd like to address the financing plan for the capital budget. $830 million of this package is general obligation bonds, and $152 million is made up of other funds, such as housing infrastructure appropriation bonds, trunk highway cash, and general fund cash, for a total of $982 million across all funds. This table shows the biennial financial impact for the governor's recommendations compared to the forecast. The debt service costs for bonds extend beyond the next biennium, but this table shows the biennial impact of the governor's recommendations to the general fund and to the trunk highway fund. In the general fund, $830 million of GO bonds is assumed to be the forecast based on the 10-year historic average and our debt guidelines. There are some savings to the governor's recommendations compared to forecast because $11 million of general obligation bonds are user financed at Minnesota State. Additionally, the housing infrastructure appropriation bonds will have a general fund impact beginning in fiscal year 27. And $28 million is included in general fund cash. Overall, the general fund impact is $28 million this biennium, and there's $371,000 in savings next biennium compared to forecast. Again, within the $82 million balance that is forecast for the end of FY27. The Trunk Highway Fund impact is $74 million and $0 next biennium, again within the $84 million balance in the Trunk Highway Fund. And finally, I just want to make note that materials for the 2024 Governor's recommendations are posted on MMB's website. You can see that link above, and that includes a summary listing of the state and local projects included in the Governor's infrastructure plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I guess I'd like to turn to Marianne Conboy because of some of the conversations we had with Deed to get some more insight. I know we've had several meetings and I still have more questions. Is to the role that MMB plays and what are some of the problems or barriers that you've run into, and what could we do better in informing local governments or obviously you're talking to state agencies, but informing nonprofits about what they're kind of up against in getting a state grant, and specifically this thing about bridge loans and when that's appropriate and when they can still get their funding.
Madam Chair, my name is Marianne Conboy. I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget. I think it's a great question that you pose, and something that I'm excited about is that MMB received funding last session for a new capital budget outreach position that will reach out proactively, especially to those nonprofits and local governments, to make sure that those all the requirements associated with general obligation bonds and general fund cash are shared up front, and there's a more there's more efforts and materials available that will be catered towards those sorts of groups. So that's something to look forward to that I think will help the process.
Have you hired that person?
We're very close.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you also have the infrastructure czar, I call him.
Yes.
And that's, we've had him before us before, Micah Intermill, who is going to help all of our projects figure out how they can get federal money. So, and our state agencies as well.
Yeah. And in regards to your question about the bridge loans, I'm just going to have to check with our debt management team because I want to make sure I get that right for the different funding sources that are involved in capital budgets.
Because I'm just fearful that some projects, and while they're waiting for the state to either approve their project or waiting for them to work out the contract, they go ahead with their project, they hire contractors, they take out loans, and then in some cases it's difficult for them to get reimbursed, and I'm not clear as to why that is and what kind of guidance we should be giving them then. So thank you, I appreciate that. Any other issues, any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner, and Ms. Conboy.
Thank you.
Now I think we're moving on to the agency overviews, and starting with the Department of Admin and Commissioner Groenvall. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for your patience as we get our slide prepared.
And we're all looking for our copies, too. Here's admin. All right.
Good afternoon. I'm Tamar Groenvall. I'm the Commissioner of Administration. It's good to be with all of you this afternoon and good to see many of you again. I'm happy to share the details of Admin's capital budget requests And I brought with me today some of our agency's property and facility experts. You also heard from a few of them a little earlier this afternoon, and I'm here to ready to answer your questions. Our capital budget request has four main parts. The first is the parking equipment and technology improvements, phase one. The governor recommends funds for admin to install parking access controls at facilities on the Capitol complex. This proposal is admin strategy to adapt to a modern workforce's parking needs and keep contract parking on the complex competitive. Capitol complex employees and visitors are looking for flexible parking options beyond monthly contracts. For instance, more options to park hourly for one day a month or to purchase a contract for a few days a week. Currently, admin is unable to provide that at most facilities. We do have it at some, because we don't have the equipment to determine the demand on the precise count of daily parkers. Installation of these controls will provide us with that usage data so we can better manage demand at facilities. This will minimize unnecessary parking space vacancies. The work will primarily be at the 14th Street ramp near the Stassen building, but we will update other facilities if funds allow. Admin appreciates the legislature's support of the parking account relief debt relief in the past, and this proposal is admin's strategy to offer more comprehensive parking amenities so the parking account remains stable. The second of our four-part request is the State Facility Renewable Energy and Storage Fund. In order to leverage funds from the Federal Inflation Reduction Act and improve the resilience of agency operations, the governor recommends funding to install renewable energy systems and energy storage upgrades at state-owned facilities. This proposal will make a real impact, especially for agencies with 24/7 resident operations like DHS, corrections, and the vets' homes, who often have the most inefficient state buildings. Potential renewable energy production systems and energy storage systems include solar arrays and geothermal heat pumps, among others. Eligible projects at state facilities can qualify for reimbursement from the federal government of 30 to 50% of the cost to install these systems. The private sector has had access to these tax credits for many years, and only recently did the federal government make them available to nonprofits and governmental entities. Admin will work with agencies to identify eligible projects and administer the logistics to receive the federal funds. A specific appropriation is needed, however, because agencies don't have excess operating funds to complete these upgrades. Our third of the four-part budget request is the Capitol Complex Security Upgrades Phase Number 3. The governor recommends providing resources to implement additional security upgrades recommended by the Advisory Committee on Capitol Area Security. These upgrades were identified in the 2014 physical security study and the 2022 security assessment update. In addition to general obligation bonds, trunk highway funds will be utilized to make security upgrades to the transportation building, which was built with trunk highway bonds in 1958. This video shows the new turnstiles and security kiosk in the admin building, which were made possible by a portion of the $10 million appropriated in 2018. While this funding has been much appreciated across the Capitol complex, considerable vulnerabilities remain, and so we are asking for resources to close those gaps. And finally, the fourth part of our four-part request is the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account, which you folks heard about a little earlier this afternoon from some of my colleagues at admin. The governor recommends additional investment to maintain CAPRA, the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. CAPRA is the state's rainy day fund and covers emergency repairs and hazardous materials abatement for state agencies. This program ensures that when state agencies experience unanticipated emergencies in their facilities, they're operational again quickly, and that construction projects are not delayed if hazardous materials are discovered. CAPR funds were most recently utilized at the Lionel Lakes Correctional Facility when an electrical main was accidentally hit by a contractor, which severed the power connection. By employing CAPR funds, admin was able to quickly get power restored and minimize disruptions for the facilities. In summary, here's an overview of our requests. These are targeted investments to address key needs across the Capitol complex and throughout the state. Thank you again for the opportunity to present admin's capital budget requests, and this concludes our presentation.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. I'm not seeing any questions. So thank you. Nice to see you again.
Thank you again for all of your time, and great to see you again, Chair, and many of the rest of you. Take care.
Next, we're inviting back Deputy Commissioner McKinnon with DEED to complete their presentation. Welcome back. Senator Jasinski has been looking forward. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And by the way, I apologize. I wasn't paying enough attention to the agenda to see Mr. McKinnon on there a second time. So.
Yeah, I wasn't either.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Kevin McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at DEED. The PowerPoint is working, and we'll present the governor's recommendations for our agency in the capital budget. We have two items, our Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program and our Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program. We use a lot of acronyms, so BDPI and TEDI is what we refer to these programs as, totaling $5 million. So the first program is our BDPI program. These are grants to local units of government outside of the seven-county metro area. We pay for 50% of eligible costs associated with the infrastructure needed to serve industrial parks, essentially, across the state, and to help our local communities lower the cost of development to, ultimately, end users. Our communities can get no more than $2 million over a two-year period. And as I mentioned, the importance of lowering the cost of development but also preparing these sites is important for our communities so that they can be ready for development. You can see the types of things that this fund helps with, whether that be water or sewer extensions, road development, etc. This program has been around for 20, 30 years and is very well known by many of our communities. So just as an example, we provided some infrastructure, streets and utilities to the Laverne Industrial Park. This supported the investment of Lineage Logistics out in Laverne, and you can see the size of the project. It's a very large project, great project for Laverne, significant investment for that community, and certainly the jobs that go along with it. The current balance is actually updated from probably the packet that you have, I believe. In, I believe it was 2020 or 2021, we received $8 million for the program. And then at the same time, every year in our general fund, we also receive a general fund appropriation of about $1.8 million. So couple that on top of the capital investment that we received from last year's bill of $10 million, we were at a relatively good starting place. And so the current balance is about $8 million that's left in that fund for the remainder, certainly of the year and obviously for next. This is no different than the previous discussion we had. These funds are available for 4 years. We do operate this program as a pipeline project. So basically what that means is as projects emerge in our communities, they apply to us, and we work with them on the project to get it finally under contract and then the work to be done. We do have a pipeline, a few projects in the pipeline. A few years ago, we increased the amount you could get to a community up to that $2 million mark. There are and have been several larger projects that we have done, like the one in the pipeline for Austin, as an example of that $2 million mark. So the money can go pretty quickly if we get a number of very large infrastructure projects. The second ask is our Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Grant Program, or TEDI. This is a joint effort that we have with the Department of Transportation. The governor's asking for $2 million for this program. And essentially what this program does is help communities with the local costs that go along with transportation improvements. And so we do a lot of the same things that we would do from an infrastructure perspective, whether it be land acquisition or reconstructing roadways to facilitate off-ramps and things from different interchanges, all with based on the business activity that it will be serving. Ultimately, there are some transportation benefits, and that comes into the review process as well, but our portion of this is to help the community with the local costs associated with the project. So a great example of this is a project we did in Dayton. They were awarded $1 million. It was basically improvements, local improvements to supplement a very busy Highway 101 interchange at I-94. Obviously facilitated more efficient transportation nodes for a number of businesses that are in the area that you can see who have pretty substantial operations in that area, but also ultimately for safety as well. The industrial area is obviously very close to that intersection, and as you would guess, they utilize that and a lot of their trucks do on a regular basis. As far as our pipeline goes, we have slightly under $2 million left in this program. We are about to make awards. This is a competitive program. We open it basically once a year. And we had almost $3 million in applications, and we'll be announcing those awards here fairly soon. Happy to answer any questions on either of these programs.
We had a suggestion from a rural county to make support for BDPI Revolving Loan Fund. Just wondering if you have any thoughts on that or if Senator Jasinski has any thoughts on that.
Madam Chair and members, to make BDPI a revolving loan fund, the way this works is cities have a project, there's infrastructure that's needed. We would come in with our portion would be a loan that would be repayable through the development, I assume, over the course of time. I've not heard of that. No one has approached us about that. So if there is more information on that, we'd be happy to take a look at it.
Senator Dibble.
Sorry, I was going to change subjects. I don't know if Senator Jasinski.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going to that, what I've seen in BDPI, there's a local match, so it's a 50-50, so the city is matching that, and the grants go in, and it's you know, again, infrastructure, wastewater, roads, bridges, streets, things like that to attract an industry there. So I think the grant way has been working very well. I guess I haven't looked into a revolving loan fund to do that, but I just know it's a very, very effective tool across Minnesota to get these new developments and usually manufacturing, industrial type uses, which are huge job creators across states. So I think it works well as it is now, but happy to look into a different way of looking at it.
Might be a way of increasing the number of people you could assist. I'm just wondering at the comment here about the tax base increase. Is estimated $134 million. in the city of Dayton alone. Oh, that's the Teddy Project. Well, whatever. Anyway, it's a thought. All right, changing the subject, Senator Dipple.
Thanks. I did want to bring up the TED program, or Teddy, I guess we call it now, which is honestly it's been around for a while.
Be the same.
I think I funded it out of my bill a few times. Yep. I'm not sure if it comes out of Senator Champion's bill ever or your bill, but I know my bill has funded it a few times, but I honestly don't understand it that well, never have. I mean, transportation economic development sounds good, but I've never really understood, what the criteria are so that a particular community competes well or not, what the demand is. You said $3 million in requests with $2 million in grants that can go out. Did I hear that right?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, that's correct, Senator Dibble.
So that doesn't sound like a lot of, I mean, I'm used to hearing about $50 million in demand for $2 million in available funds. So I'm wondering if communities know about it to the extent that they should or could. And also, I'm curious to know about what kind of funds this grant leverages and if that's one of the analyses and criteria that we scrutinize. You don't have to answer these questions. I think what we're going to do is bring you into our committee and have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to comment at all, Deputy Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, what I would say is a lot of communities base their applications on the available funding, which is obviously published. As far as criteria and those things, happy to talk in more detail about that, and certainly about the leverage and how not only the transportation project is a piece of the leverage, but ultimately the business investment that we're trying to facilitate along with this. So happy to answer those questions when appropriate.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Chair Zelli with the Metropolitan Council.
Good afternoon, Chair
Welcome.
Pappas, and good afternoon, Senators, members of the committee. While Hannah's setting up, and our PowerPoint works, so it's great to have the opportunity to be before you. I'm Charlie Zelli, Chair of the Metropolitan Council, and I really want to thank this committee. I know a number of you joined us on some tours to regional parks, saw some bison. Maybe I think there was a tour of our wastewater plant in St. Paul, so I appreciate.
We were very fortunate that we had an outdoor tour of your wastewater treatment plant. We have gone into wastewater treatment plants. It was an experience not to be repeated.
Yes, that's part of
Senator Pa, right?
Madam Chair, part of the hazard and interest in this line of work. That's right.
Yeah.
I'm actually joined today by a number of experts in the three areas that we're going to be covering. Staff includes Katie Roth, who manages our BRT program, Emmett Mullen, who manages our parks program, Sam Paskey and Walter Atkins, who are experts in this INI and the wastewater business, and of course, you know, Judd Chetnan and Hannah Palmer. I'm going to take you through this presentation to talk about three areas as part of the governor's request. And I will, to move things along, just get right to it. First, with the Arterio Busway Capital Improvement Program. I think many of you recognize the value of these Arterio Bus Rapid Transit lines. There's three operating. There's several that are under development. And then even more kind of on the drawing boards. It's really telling that the A line now is actually exceeding ridership as where it was in 2019, pre-pandemic. In fact, when it started a number of years ago, it already exceeded some of the lines that were there. And that really becomes from the enhanced kind of quality of the service, the express nature of the runs. They're over as much as 25% faster. Really great stations. And I'm kind of curious, we have a picture with a snowstorm. That's a little nostalgia for you from winter. but you'll know that the A, C, and D lines are going well. B is under construction. And they have been really kind of the interconnecting spines to our larger transit network. This $37 million request proposal is specifically for the H line, which runs from Minneapolis to the Sunray Shopping Center. It will have the opportunity to leverage federal funds through the Small Starts program. So we believe this would score well and is appropriate given the past success. The work would be bond eligible, environmental work, right-of-way acquisition, design, construction, and as I say, there are more lines coming if there were ever excess funds from federal funds, we would be able to apply it to J, K, and L. This is the line east-west, so it really covers both east and west metro. And more importantly is this slide, really showing the potentials for additional ABRTs. You know, we would expect these system to be in place by 2030, which is very soon. And then, of course, beyond that, there's even more opportunity for specific corridors, and again, to replace slower moving bus lines but heavily traveled, to bring in this express service that also kind of connects all these transit ways together. So this vision for Metro Transit to keep people living their lives within 30 minutes of wherever they want to go without long connections is really coming to fruition. So with that, I'll just jump into the inflow and infiltration program as part of our environmental services. We know our commitment to water is vast within the Metro Council kind of family of both planning and operations. We are obviously engaged in wastewater, but we also care a lot about water quality. We measure it, research it, and we work with local communities on their plans. But really look at the wastewater. It's a very efficient system. 9 wastewater treatment plants. You've maybe seen the largest one in St. Paul. One of the ways we've been so efficient is that we have been smarter people 50 years ago made the investment to separate groundwater, stormwater from the wastewater. And that allows that wastewater system to be much more efficient and to kind of meet the demand without having spillage into any of our rivers, nor to be able to keep our rates down. That's one of the reasons we're probably one of the most affordable systems in the country. And if you talk to some other older industrial cities or look at them, they don't have that separation. And what's involved in that separation, as you can see, this is kind of a model of sewer systems. And when you look at the home, the business, attaching to the city system, which attaches to our kind of larger Met Council managed interceptor system, the wastewater, the stormwater, goes into lakes and rivers more freely and doesn't eat up the capacity. And the inflow and infiltration program is a way to protect that capacity of the wastewater system. Even more so. And it's an incredible investment and very important, we think, for many cities who have participated in this program. When we have a little roots and decay of old pipes, the clean water from rains or sprinkling systems seeps into our wastewater system and hurts not just the broader capacity of our wastewater treatment plants, but actually the pipes many of these smaller communities. So it's very popular with our cities. There are very clear guidelines as to which cities are eligible. And of course, this funds are provided on a 50 matching basis. So it's often a kind of an opportunity for cities to do the work that they need to do, but to have the state come in with this program gives it a real leg up.
Before you go on, Chair Zelli, what has been, that usually there's a fairly small amount that is appropriated in the bonding bill, and then it looks like you also match that with Metro Council funds. I'm asking that question. And my second part of the question then is, you know, what's the demand for assistance? I mean, there's a lot of cities here. We've heard from some of them that are have a really big problem with I&I. Probably more than they can handle on their own. So,
And really,
bringing up the expert.
I'm joined by Sam Paskey. I will say, and then Sam will kick me if I'm wrong, that we do have the Met Council matching as part of our parks program, but this wastewater system is a pass-through. Oh, he's looking
correct.
At me, so
yeah.
I'll
okay, got it.
Take
I got it. I see. An additional $12 million, that was from our bonding bill last year.
Last year, we had significant catch-up. Yeah. On some of the past deficiency, but there is a need that exceeds what the governor's recommending. However, there's with what was appropriated last year, and then the construction business and the actual contractor's ability to kind of deliver a lot of those programs, we don't think we're that far behind. But Sam, can you answer the
question? Yeah, Madam
thank
Chair.
You. Welcome, Mr. Paskey.
Yep, Sam
just
Paskey.
Repeat your name, Sam Paskey.
Yep, Sam Paskey. There is no council match for this program, but it is 100% pass-through.
Answer more about the need, though.
Yeah. Oh, the need. Yeah. Local government has to maintain the pipes that then feed into the regional system, and there can be a struggle to do that. So we're trying to support the local capacity to make those infrastructure investments. These funds don't cover all of the need. It would be extreme if we were to calculate even what that would be.
Well, I'm really interested in more information on the need. If you could provide that to the committee, like, do you have a backlog in requests? What's the process? I mean, we've had some cities that have come to us to give us an earmark because they're not able to do the local match, or they're too far down the list with the Met Council. So, you know, we would just as soon go through the grant program and, you know, fund it adequately than to have everyone come to us for an earmark.
What I would propose is the two individuals who normally would be presenting the details are both out of state right now. I'd propose we provide that detail level information on local need to you next week sometime.
That would be helpful. Thank you. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of along those lines with, you know, your priorities and what you're asking for from the Met Council, it's $44.5 million. And I know the busway rapid transit is an important thing, but to my understanding, I mean, you get hundreds of millions of dollars collected through the county tax. Why aren't you using those funds to leverage the federal funds in that and asking more for the I&I? Because I know I&I is important, but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Met Council receives hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars from the county tax for transportation that could be used for the bus rapid transit, correct?
Yeah,
Chair Zelli.
Madam Chair and Senator Jasinski, the new as in last year, sales tax in the metro area associated with transit is eligible for capital repairs, and mostly for operations. So that a longer term is certainly eligible, but given the history of the ABRTs and the ability to use the operating funds that we have to operate this much more robust system, we know that we will, over time, have extra funds, and there is also additional service that we'd like to provide, and some of those were part of the part of the legislation, like a micro transit, like some free fare zones, certainly taking over quite a bit of the costs of all transitways now. So I think that there's been a kind of an appropriate balance with some state funds toward this program that's been matched not just by ourselves but by the federal program. So
I'll think about you,
just, Senator Jasinski.
I know, and I think I got to calculate. I think the 3-4 cent sales tax or 3/4 cent sales tax is going to bring them about $400 million per year, and that's in addition to the transit taxes collected. So. Again, seeing those funds to go to bus rapid transit and money requesting here go more towards the INI and things like that, I think makes more sense from us as far as what we're funding them through the bonding bill. So just my last comments.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We're kind of all about clean water and sewer here. We see the great need around the state. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, we still have parks.
Well, I want to touch on parks. This is just a map of some of those cities that you're many of them hearing from. I want to just touch on parks, and that is a matched program, so I understand that's confusing. We actually give $2 for every $3 as part of this program, some from the Met Council levy. The governor is proposing $2.5 million. This, again, is 100% pass-through to the 10 implementing agencies or regional parks systems. I don't need to tell all of you how important the parks have been over the past number of years. A really tremendous metropolitan area asset, 55,000 acres and 55 different parks in those 10 implementing agencies. Also includes over nearly 500 miles of regional trails, which all of this we expect, particularly the trails, to be increasing in the years ahead. So here's a list of the cities the implementing agencies that would that actually have specific projects associated with these funds. So the one thing that benefits this program is not only the additional funds that Met Council is able to match, but a real agreement among those implementing agencies on how we divide the funds for their specific projects based upon a formula that they've all agreed on, both on population and on and some of the usage of their parks. So here's, as you can see, where the 11 projects are across the region, and that is our report, and I'm happy to answer any other questions or have people here who do.
Sorry, I'm just a little bit behind you. The breakdown by agency, did you say that was on slide 19? Did you say this is what they were appropriated from last year's bill?
No, this is what the $2.5 million
would,
plus the roughly $1.7 million together is this $4.1 million, and then how those funds would be allocated among the agencies.
So I'd be interested, though, in also learning about how you spent last year's funds.
Sure.
That would be helpful.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we can get that to you next week.
Great. There were just two handouts, so I was confused by the two.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, any questions about the parks? Anyone? All right, thank you very much, Chair Zelli.
Thank you.
And then finally we have Chair Ho, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
You're the chair.
I'm the chair, and Chair Zelli is the chair, but you're the commissioner, right? I didn't call you Senator Ho. That would have really been a degradation. Demotion.
Aspiration. Chair Pappas and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I'm the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. I'm here with Dan Kitzberger, who's my legislative director. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the ways in which our work intersects with your committee and the governor's budget recommendations. Just want to start for a moment to just ground this in need. We have a shortage of about 50,000 housing units still in the state. About 10,000 of the 30,000 HUD Section 8 units have contracts that will expire in the next 4 years, putting them and the federal dollars that make them affordable at risk of being lost permanently. Over 8,000 people experience homelessness each night, nearly 2,000 of whom are sleeping outside. And people facing chronic homelessness has increased 123% since 2017. Housing instability is impacting more Minnesotans. Nearly 215,000 renter households are making less than $50,000 a year and spending more than 30% of their income on rent. And Black, Indigenous, and households of color are more likely to be housing cost burdened, be evicted from their housing, experience homelessness, and are less likely to become homeowners. So that is the context in which I bring the governor's proposal. The governor has proposed $50 million this year in housing infrastructure bonds, and this would create or rehab an estimated 500 homes, as well as $7.5 million for public housing rehabilitation that would rehabilitate or preserve an estimated 375 homes. These are modest compared to last year's investments, but it's crucial that we keep moving forward with investments in housing capital. We know that the development community, to whom I still had to say no to many, even with the amounts that were available last year. We know that the development community needs to see the signal that the state is going to keep chipping away at this housing shortage until we get it right. In terms of cost to get to the estimate of homes, we're estimating about $100,000 per unit for something done with housing infrastructure, and about $20,000 per unit for something that's done with public housing. It's actually up from about $10,000 per unit with public housing, but as we got more resources, we can actually do larger preservation and rehab projects. So let me dive in just a little into housing infrastructure bonds. So just a refresher, why do we have housing infrastructure bonds? It's because 95% of the housing in Minnesota is privately owned, and geo bonds are limited to publicly owned units. So the pie slice over there is the 5% of publicly owned housing that would be eligible for a geo bond, like public housing preservation. But the vast majority of the housing in the state is not geo eligible. And that's why these were created, going back actually precursors to the 2012 session. And since 2012, housing infrastructure resources have been the largest state source of capital for housing development to deal with the shortage. I also think it's really important to understand that housing infrastructure bonds are an incredible leverage tool. They leverage one-to-one, including federal funds from HUD, tax credits, and other federal sources. They are also something that that my colleagues across the country are envious of. We were the creators of housing infrastructure bonds, and it's one of the tools that we have that other state housing finance agencies don't. Housing infrastructure supports a continuum of uses, pictured here. The preservation of federally assisted rental housing, again, important to keep those units as federally assisted, keep the federal assistance there instead of having those buildings sold off for other purposes. They help us build and rehabilitate permanent supportive housing, which is a proven method of helping people with even the longest histories of homelessness become stably housed and work on recovery in other parts of their lives. It helps us create affordable housing for seniors and allows us to do senior housing for seniors on a fixed income, seniors who make the least. It now finances manufactured home community acquisition and infrastructure. So we've been able to support a cooperative ownership of manufactured home communities, and we've done really critical infrastructure work, oftentimes where you have poor drinking water, undrinkable drinking water, sewage seepage, bad roads such that school buses and garbage trucks can't get in and are a safety hazard for residents, as well as storm shelters and other electrical work. It helps us develop single-family homes, including in community land trusts, and it does, as of last year, just more new construction of deeply affordable rental housing. So here's some examples of housing infrastructure bonds at work. In this last selection period, we selected a permanent supportive housing project in Duluth called Welch Place. You can see what the project itself will do, but basically more supportive housing to help people off the streets. This is an example of a rental housing preservation project in Hutchinson. I don't think we got the best side of this building in the shot, but this is the shot that was available to us. But again, a really important preservation deal. It's the ability for Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership to acquire and rehab and keep, therefore, this program and the USDA rental assistance that it has in service to the people of that community. This is an example of a manufactured home community infrastructure project that we recently selected, the Normandale Manufactured Home Community down in Redwood Falls. And this is a modest investment that's going to help replacing roads and sidewalks, deal with the failing storm sewer system, and it also is leveraging local money from the city of Redwood Falls. And then we've done some single-family new construction. This is one from our most recent announcements, the Homeownership Program for Equity in Golden Valley, $3.3 million of housing infrastructure for 20 new homes. And this is where the city is actually making public land available. So again, highly leveraged for owner-occupied, single-family, duplex, and row homes. So smaller homes, more affordable for people in the Golden Valley community. And then they're all going to be placed in a community land trust to ensure long-term affordability. So in summary, since 2012, $612 million has been committed, leveraging over $1.3 billion in total development cost. Nearly 6,000 units have been created or preserved, including units that are in the pipeline now. About 55% of the households that were renting were people of color, and about 56% of households included a person with a disability. We do have these newer expanded eligible uses. The single family development expanded in 2020, and nearly $80 million has been committed that will impact over 1,300 homes. And then the manufactured home community acquisition and infrastructure was added in 2018, and we've committed over $20 million, which impacts 1,700 lots. Let me pivot from housing infrastructure bonds to public housing rehabilitation, which is general obligation bonding. We fund capital improvements in publicly owned housing. One of the reasons that we do that is that even though the federal government built those units, the federal government has not kept up with the deferred maintenance on those units. And so even though they are a critical part of the housing for low-income seniors, people with disabilities, and families in communities across the state, it's an aging stock. And so the work that we've done really deals with really basic health and safety, fire suppression, accessibility, plumbing, elevators, HVAC, windows and roofs. From 2012 to 2020, we've done 63.5 million, 115 projects, 8,500 units with this public housing preservation. Here's some examples. Lakeview High Rise in Wilmer. If you've driven through Wilmer, you will have noticed this building. It's probably the tallest residential building in Wilmer. 127 one-bedroom units that was built in 1971. It has a preference to elderly and disabled households, and it's owned and managed by the Candiohi County HRA. They got funding in 14, 17, and 18 to do the work in phases. The most recent scope was all the building exterior, really around air quality and energy efficiency for the building. This is Cedar High Apartments in Minneapolis, 25-story building, 191 units, owned by the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. I think, sadly, we all know this property because this is where the fatal fire occurred. And this is where we've been able to use a POP investment in order to install a fire sprinkler system throughout the building including the common spaces and tenant units, the fire pump panel replacement, and fire alarm system upgrades. I got a slide that wasn't in your packet, but I wanted to just highlight that of the public housing bonding and cash that was made available, we have decided to put it out in phases, not all at once, because we think that the smaller PHAs may not be ready for all at once. We have some considerations around the cash that we need to think through in terms of how the cash solicitation would happen differently than the geo bond solicitation. And so we're putting out $41 million. It's actually out now with applications due on March 6th. But I'll just note that even though 41 is only a portion of what was designated by the legislature last session, this is much larger than any round of POP that we've been able to do historically. I think previously the largest year we had was $16 million. So it's the fact that we have that process underway, you know, I feel good about, and I think it's also going to help us make sure that the organizations, and some of these Greater Minnesota public housing authorities, like this is the building they own. And so they don't have big staffs that are managing large portfolios. So we've done an awful lot to try to make sure that the program is accessible in communities all across the state. Which brings me to slide, a map. I love maps. This is a map of all the places that, that POP has been invested between 2012 and 2020. And you'll see that the distribution of dots, 64% of the funds have gone to Greater Minnesota. About half of the units have been in Greater Minnesota versus the metro because the buildings are larger in the metro. And it's just done a lot around health and safety as well as energy efficiency and climate resilience. So I really hope that there's an opportunity to have housing included in a bonding bill this year. We did go big. We went really big last year, but it wasn't enough to satisfy what we need to do to meet the housing needs of Minnesota. And so continuing to make these investments is just really critical. And I would be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. I believe last year that the housing infrastructure bonds went through the housing committee. So I know the governor has put it into his capital investment proposal, but it's not clear at this point whether it's going to be in our bill or if it'll be in a, you know, a separate bill through the housing committee.
Nor is it clear to me, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Any questions from anyone? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ms. Carlson, you want to tell us about next week? Have a good weekend, Commissioner.
Thank you for that. So next week, we will not be meeting on Tuesday, but we will be meeting on Thursday, the 29th. We anticipate hearing from the DNR, MPCA, Bowser, PFA, DHS, MnDOT, and the Amateur Sports Commission. And then we will continue agency overviews included in the governor's recommendations into the following week.
All right, thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Then, with nothing more to come before us, oh, Senator Housley.
Madam Chair, do you want to tell the committee what you're doing tomorrow morning for breakfast?
Is it tomorrow morning? Oh, my goodness. Well, you're all invited to join me for breakfast, where I'm the alumni of the year for Metro State. No, I did send out invitations to a few people. Karen Helsley was one of them.
Yes, I just wanted to congratulate you and have a good breakfast. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
It's not tomorrow.
It's not tomorrow. Oh, it's not tomorrow, Karen. It's next week. Oh, that's why Micah breakfast for me is tomorrow. Yeah, that's why I was confused by what you said. Oh, it's tomorrow?
Oh, next
week. Next
okay.
week, March 1st or 2nd first. Or something.
Thank you.
March 1st.
Thanks. I got to change that. All Good right. thing I didn't show up.
Good thing. All right, the committee is adjourned.